This is The Guardian.
I'm Grace Dent, and this is Comfort Eating from The Guardian. A podcast where we pay homage to the lesser celebrated foods in life. Because even as a restaurant critic, I believe the food that matters most is often that snack you cobble together when you're curled up on the sofa. Each week, I ask my guest to lift the lid on what comfort foods have seen them through their lives. Because you can tell a lot about a person from what they eat behind closed doors.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, friends. You find me, as you so often do, in my kitchen, preparing for another fabulous episode of Comfort Eating. It's Monday morning. No better time, in my book, for a little snack that I love. It is sweet pickled cucumber slices. I like to get them out of the jar, just dangle them into my mouth with a little oat milk chaser. I like to feel like I'm at a debauched cocktail bar. I'm actually in my own house. Today, I have Amma Asante coming round for a chat. She's a BAFTA award-winning movie director with her films like Belle and A United Kingdom telling historical tales of love and the trials and tribulations that come with it. She's also directed the likes of Cate Blanchett and Elizabeth Moss in small screen hits The Handmaid's Tale and Mrs. America. Despite all of this, I have got a tune stuck in my head, which goes, ma-da-bow-bow. And that is because as a child, Amma Asante starred in, you've guessed it, Grange Hill. She was in all of my favourite storylines and even went to the White House on the invitation of Nancy Reagan for her seminal 1980s anti-drugs campaign. As much as I could make it so, this whole episode won't just be about that. And I want to know what a Hollywood director eats when they've said cut and they're back home getting cosy on the couch. Let's just have one more pickle or two. Amma Asante.
Hello.
Welcome to Comfort Eating.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Look, this is something that people probably don't realise at home, but you can't be shocked because you're a film and a TV director. I make telly. I spend a lot of time from about the sixth take onwards spitting out the food that I'm eating on camera. You know when you're doing a take?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the first one, fine. The second one, not so good. And then as a director, how many takes is acceptable before an actor starts spitting food in a bucket?
Before they start gagging. Five?
Five.
I think five reasonably. I mean, it depends how how good an actor you are. Because I think if you're not such a good actor, by three, we can see it in your face. And if you're a really good actor, then maybe by five, I could say, okay, it's, I know six is going to give it away. I know six is going to kind of be the God swallow this face. Don't want that. So I think for good actors, five. For not so good actors, and some not so good actors are very charming.
What's a good food to be pretending to eat on screen?
Something that doesn't require a lot of chewing. So something that's easy, where you're not, you know, not a bit of bad beef that you're chewing and chewing and chewing and chewing, which is not, it's just not very elegant. So something they can chew and swallow easily, you know?
Soup.
Soup is good. Soup is really good as long as they don't slurp. Yeah, that's just, no, that's not good.
On comfort eating, I ask every guest to bring in their ultimate comfort snack, yes. Something that they like to eat that up until now, perhaps they didn't want the whole world to know. Amma, what have you brought me?
Isn't this wonderful?
My heart is just filled with happiness. This is the first jug of custard that we have seen.
Is it really?
It's the first jug of custard. Now, and what are these? A little...
Let me see. They call them different names in different countries, but I call them Madeleine cakes. Sometimes I call them Madeleine boats. There's a lot of history behind these. No, you're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. Put it back.
I've made a huge mistake.
Put it back in.
Sorry. Okay, let's go.
You don't mind custard?
I love custard.
You have to love custard today. This is how you do it. And you need... Wait.
Custard, to me, is one of the biggest proofs that...
Isn't it?
That God exists.
It's very... To me, it's very... Well, it's luxurious to me.
I've got in front of me two bowls of spongy madeleines. And Amma is spooning custard over them. And it's just happiness. You know, it's comforting and it's sating and it's sweet.
May I say hot custard?
Hot custard.
Hot custard, not school dinner custard, although it does remind me of school dinners and the very British way of doing custard.
Very British.
There's nothing posh about this.
Does this remind you of being a child? Am I allowed to go in now?
Yes.
I feel like I don't want to make another faux pas.
As they say in Denmark, Vesco. Bon appétit in France. Let's go for it. It does remind me of being a child a lot. Mm. It reminds me of course, school dinners when they were done well. Mm. I looked forward to the desserts at school. This dessert reminds me of my dad.
Why is that?
Because he used to love this dessert. He used to send me to the shop and say, go and get a packet of madeleines.
Oh.
We were the only two that really enjoyed them. We were the only two that really enjoyed this. And this was, I don't know if he knew that he was making my version of my favourite school dessert or not. I remember saying to my best friend a few years ago, I'm craving like madeleine cakes, I'm craving rice pudding, and I don't know why. And she said, it's your dad's birthday today, you do realise that.
Yeah.
And it was my dad's and he was gone and she recognised it and I hadn't, but I just had this terrible, but good craving, you know, terrible nice craving. And it makes me happy and it makes me feel warm. And it's like, you know, I've got a cup of tea next to me as well. Cup of tea is like a cuddle from my mum. Mm-hmm. And madeleines and custard are like a cuddle from my dad.
People know your films. We're going to come to your BAFTA later.
Mm-hmm.
Before you were behind the camera, you were in front of it.
I'm sorry, everybody. That's true.
Please don't apologise, please, because I get very excited about this and I'm trying to keep that under wraps and remain professional. You played Cheryl Webb in Grange Hill, which for people who don't know, was a children's soap on the BBC, centred around a fictional school in North London.
No, it was real. It was real.
It was real in my heart. It ran for 30 years. Its impact on a whole generation of kids cannot be overestimated. I've got so many questions. If anybody who's listening to this who watched Grange Hill, Amma was part of the... the era, like to me, the absolute, the classic era of Zamo and Jackie.
Yeah.
And Roland and Benny.
Yeah.
And like the main people, the people that everyone, and you, and I've looked on YouTube and like seen you like in the video, just say no and things like that.
Getting it all wrong.
No, getting it so right. So it's so, it's really, it's so lovely to sit here with you in front of me because I'm like, yeah, you were part of that. Let's start. But what was your favourite storyline?
So for me, my favourite storyline was one of the toughest. Mm. I think it was my favourite storyline because I think it's one of the reasons why I'm a director today. And it was the Zamo heroine storyline. I think the kind of combination of the power of that story, its impact on the community that I lived in, which was just a very average working class community. So its impact on the world around us, our local world, the quality of the acting, which I thought was sublime. I think the quality of the writing as well for a children's show, you know, to be able to pull this story into a storyline that kids could understand and that might have an impact on them, might have an effect on a world that was in trouble, heroine-wise, at that time.
So bold, though, to take
the
really good-looking, cheeky chappy of Grange Hill, who everyone loved, and then give him a storyline which adults were quite outraged in a way that this was now in this children's soap where he's taking a Class A substance.
Yes. I think it was very honest. I think it was very courageous. And I think despite the fact that I think many of the brilliant people I was working with at the time, the young actors, probably didn't know the full impact of what they were doing. It planted seeds in me that kind of sprouted much later in life.
The storyline leads to Just Say No. It was this huge anti-drugs campaign led by Nancy Reagan, former First Lady of the USA. And then Grange Hill, the kids asked to the White House to meet her. Like, is there a moment where you're all there about to meet her and you just have this kind of strange out-of-body experience and think, what are we doing?
I think we were kids. Mm-hmm. So I think what we knew was that there was a possibility of nine of us out of a cast of, I think, about 25 or something like that. But what we knew is that New York and Washington were going to be our destination if we got picked. And being picked was like getting the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory golden ticket. Yeah. You know, nobody knew who was going to be chosen until the day an envelope arrived at their door. And I can remember knowing that across 3 days, these envelopes were going to be delivered. And I remember seeing a car pull up and a guy get out and he had a big brown envelope in his hand. And I remember screaming at my dad, go and answer the door. There's a man. And my dad did. And then he looked at it and it had a BBC on the front of the envelope. And so my dad gave it to me and I ripped it open. It really was like, it really was like, I was like Charlie. And it said, you have been invited to go to America, you know, Virgin Airlines had just become a thing at the time and we were going to fly over on Virgin and it said that in the letter and all of that. It was all that was a huge adventure that I've never forgotten.
What was life like on set on Grange Hill?
It was just a lot of fun.
Did they feed you on Grange Hill?
They did. We were at Elstree Studios along with a brand new soap called EastEnders. Mm. So it would be us and Doc Cotton and Ian Beale and, you know, all of those people who were only just being introduced really to an audience at that time.
All in the canteen.
In the canteen. And we got great, 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 great food. Really good food. For me, it was like restaurant quality food every time. Every time we got lunch. So it was, they often had steaks. Yeah, they often had a steak and chips and some peas, maybe. Pie and chips, a nice beef pie. A nice beef pie, as I like to say. A bit of pie. I went straight for the meat, straight for the potatoes, meat and vegetables, as few vegetables as possible. But they gave you a good range and it was always hot. Hot is very important to me, as you might imagine.
Yes. You're having your chicken pie and Doc Cotton's there.
She was lovely.
Yeah.
She was lovely. She was always gorgeous and she was always kind.
Yeah. Before you were portraying the life of a teenager in North London, you were living the real life of a little girl in South London with your siblings and your parents who had moved to the UK from Ghana. What do you remember of life at home as a kid?
So home life is this almost impossible to explain to someone who hasn't experienced it. Absolute internitted combination of Ghana in the UK, yeah. Or a version of Ghana. Let's say a version of Ghana. So
which bits of Ghana?
Well, you know, I'm hearing the language. I'm hearing my parents going in and out of English and in Shwe, which is the one of the languages of Ghana. My parents are both very Ghanaian and both integrated at the same time. Yeah. Outside of the house is a very white world at that time. It isn't in Streatham now, but it was at that time, which was not necessarily always welcoming or particularly welcoming to anybody who was black or brown. So it was kind of two different worlds. And they're definitely, I think, you know, as a kid, you're definitely in survival mode without knowing that you're in survival mode. And you don't know anything different. You don't have anything else to compare it with. You don't know what it's like to be a little black kid growing up in Ghana or a little white kid growing up in the UK. You're just this combination of things.
So not many black families around you.
No, there was one other black family on the street and their son was in my class, but he was a boy. Didn't hang around with boys.
So average night, Amma's house after school, who's cooking and what are you having for tea?
My mum would cook for a few days. So what I mean is my mum would cook a good stew.
Yeah.
And the stew would, she might cook it on a Sunday and it would last until a Tuesday maybe.
What kind of stew? I'm going to need specific ingredients in this stew.
It would be, I have to do better because I never learned how to cook it myself, but it would be tomato and onion and lots and lots of spices, cayenne and black pepper and all sorts of spices, really good meat, but chopped up.
Chicken?
Sometimes she'd make the same base of stew and then she'd either put chicken in it or she'd put beef in it.
Right. See,
that would be often with a good old jollof rice, a good old Ghanaian jollof rice, often, which, you know, jollof rice was created to give you everything you needed, to give you the vegetables, the rice, the meat. So that in itself had some meat mixed up in it. Could be some chicken, but she'd never give us a chicken jollof rice if it wasn't a chicken stew.
If I took you somewhere and went, this is jollof rice, what's the one thing that if you saw it, you'd go, Grace, this isn't jollof rice?
Oh my God, if it had currants in it. If it had currants in it.
You're not into a currant.
I'm not into a currant. And that's not jollof rice. If you put anything sweet in your rice, it's not a jollof rice.
What if they said, but Amma, it's a spin.
They'd have to spin it away. They could spin it on back to the kitchen or to someone else's table. Because that's not, I mean, jollof rice is my mum to me as well. Yeah. So it's like, if you bring me an inauthentic jollof rice, it is blasphemy. According to me. So it's, and I think that a lot of African kids born in the UK pretty much feel the same way. It's like, don't bring me. It kind of reminds me of babysitting my nephew one day and he was about two and he said, draw an aeroplane. And I drew an aeroplane and he screamed and said, that's not an aeroplane. And because it was not how his mum drew the aeroplane.
Yeah.
And it was fundamentally offensive to him that I should do something outside of the way that his mum did it. And that's how I feel about jollof rice. Exactly like that.
So, when you were 11, you started stage school.
Yes.
Rather than a regular secondary school.
Yeah.
How does this come about?
My dad was So my dad was the dreamer and my mum was the really practical one, but in a good way. I had a very, very bad experience where my mum, who worked nonstop, I'd asked her to take some time off work and come and see me in what was considered an end of term dance class performance. She had taken time off, come along, seen the performance, but I wasn't in it. And as we walked home, she sort of said, I said, Mum, did you enjoy it? And she said, yeah, I loved it, but you weren't in it, darling. Where were you? And I said, well, I was told at the last minute I couldn't be in it. I was only in the finale anyway. But I was told I couldn't be in it because the song was called Blue Eyes and I didn't have blue eyes.
Oh, hang on. No.
Yes. It was from that moment that my dad started to look for a stage school for me. But he really wanted me to go to a school that was mixed. Mm. I then audition or go for a meeting at Barbara Speake Stage School, which is a school I end up going to, the drama, the stage school. And I walk in and it's like the kids from Fame. And it's lunchtime and it's raining outside.
So leg warmers.
There's leg warmers in the stage and they're doing splits in the air and it's all too much. It's too much. I said to my dad, I can't do it. I can't do it. I don't want it.
It's exhausting though, because you've walked in and the stage school kids being stage school kids. Is that not another level of
outsiderness for me?
Because, I mean, could you ever do the splits in midair?
No, I couldn't, but I certainly became one of those stage school kids. I definitely became one. I mean, it took about a year to convert me, but I did convert to the church of stage school madness.
Tap dancing.
Everywhere.
Making people supermarkets.
Hi!
Making people watch your shows that you've made up in the living room.
Yeah, I was doing a bit of that anyway with my family, but now I was doing it to everyone. So I was doing it to everyone and everywhere.
Did your dad always watch what you did?
Everything. You know, I remember my dad coming to my first school show, and this was the kind of healing moment for him. And I was singing The Greatest Love of All. And my dad, I can just remember my dad, seeing my dad in the audience and him, I mean, he was the stage school dad, and he loved it. And, you know, he cried, because he cried a lot.
Your bond with him sounds incredible.
Yeah, it was. It was really, really lovely. It was really lovely.
Was food important to the pair of you?
Yeah, because my dad was very much an African man, and he was very much the version of the African man who kind of enjoyed cooking for himself and his kids. So yes, when my mum was around, he loved her to cook for him. My dad would come home late from work, because he'd start late, so he'd finish late, and he would always say, have you eaten? And turn to each of us and say, have you eaten? Have you eaten? Have you eaten? Yeah. Before he put a spoonful of food in his mouth. And if we hadn't eaten, he'd want us to eat with him or before he ate. And the other thing he would do is, even if we said yes, he would always say, do you want some? Mm. And that was because I kind of realized he must have seen, experienced, or understood difficulty in some way. And I'm not quite sure how, because, you know, Ghana never went through, you know, there was never a lack of food ever. In Ghana. But, you know, I know my dad didn't go to school till he was 11. He got his first pair of shoes when he went to school for the first time. He was a very intelligent man, very intelligent young boy that got, you know, very, very high marks in his district. I think he got the top marks in his district, actually, when he did his the exams that you took then when you were 16. But I think he had experienced some form of scarcity. And so for him, that meant that he had to see that his children were okay before he was okay. And food was how he expressed that.
You left stage school. You'd already seen some success. You'd been on telly on Grange Hill. So it seems like a bit of a handbrake turn to then go to secretarial college.
I wanted to please my mum. And what if she was right? You know, and like I said earlier, I didn't really know where I was going. I didn't really know what I was doing. When we started Grange Hill, we were sat down. Everybody that started Grange Hill at that time was sat down and given a sort of verbal instruction manual of how life was going to change. And the thing about doing a show like Grange Hill is, no matter what
privileges you do get, you never disconnect from the real world. You're not Madonna. You're not Michael Jackson. You're still always in the real world.
Yeah.
And so I just go into Secretarial College on Tottenham Court Road, and I just start the exercises, and I'm
going to have to know some stats here. How many words a minute can you do?
I could probably only now probably do about, I could probably do about 50 words per minute, because I'm typing all the time now, and I'm typing, oh, I'm not one of those that uses one finger.
No, it's, I type properly. Like, it's really painful when you see someone that is like that.
Yeah.
Is there a crossover between learning to type and writing a script?
100%. I mean, so I then, after going to Secretarial College, I'm doing I forget what they called them at the time, but it was like a work training course. So part of the training is you go and work. I start then typing out, trying to get my typing speed up, and I'm doing it through just doing copy typing through what's in the paper. And then I start typing out one day a screenplay that's in my head. I give it to a friend.
The script
to say, oh, I've been playing around with something, and I think that you could give this to a writer who could do something with this, who could make this into something. Because I think there's an idea there. And I've said, it's just my mum and my dad, really. And what I don't know is he then passes it on to real executives at Fox Studios in America. And I get called for a meeting.
I've got to say that I've never talked to a BAFTA-winning scriptwriter who only wrote their first script in order to improve their touch typing.
It was the flukiest fluke.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You start working as a writer in your late 20s.
Yeah.
Your first big TV series is commissioned. Brothers and Sisters.
Yeah.
Show based on the members of a gospel choir in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Biggest gig of your career to date.
Yeah.
And it was one of those productions. You look at the cast list now.
Yeah. It's funny.
So many people went on to find huge success. You look and you go, oh, it's just Stephen Graham and David Harewood.
Isn't it amazing?
I love it.
I'm so proud. I really am, because they're great people as well.
When a fresh actor walks in like that, who goes on to be huge, is there an innate star quality?
Yeah, definitely. It's about to happen again very shortly on a project that I'm working on now, and I can see it. There definitely is a star quality. It's not something you can break down. They do something with an audience. An audience can relate and engage and wants to go on a journey with them for some reason. And you feel that because they have the same impact on you that they're going to have on everybody else.
So you're living in West London at this point. Paint me a picture of what you're doing when you're not working.
I'm a bit of a recluse, to be honest with you. So at that time, I was watching I loved TV back then. We didn't have as many options as we have now.
I love that you say that you're a recluse, because I totally identify with that.
Yeah,
I find that people don't, I think they don't believe you when you say that, you know, they don't believe people like me and you that we're recluses.
Yeah.
But there is a real joy in just being on the sofa.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And I used to love, you know, it's crazy as it sounds. I mean, today it's what do I do to kind of stop my brain from working? I love a good old Housewives. I love a Beverly Hills or an Atlanta or what. But back then it was American soaps. And I loved Sunset Boulevard.
What are you eating at this point? You got some popcorn?
I'm eating some of what we're eating now, I can tell you that. I'm eating a lot of custard and sponge. I love a big bag of crisp. I can finish a very large bag of crisp quite quickly.
What kind are you going for?
Onion and chives. I'm going for...
How do you feel about a sweet chili crisp?
I'm not really that into a sweet, unless it's a good Asian sweet and sour. That's the whole thing with the currants and the jello fries.
Yeah, I
don't like the sweet with the savoury. The only people I think that can do it really well are if it's in Korean food or Thai food, give it to me any day of the week. I will spend my life like a good sweet beef something or other.
Yeah.
I can do that. I can do if it's Asian influence, then I can do that. I love that. So yeah, I'm usually a good double packet of Jaffa cakes.
Two packets.
Yeah. I can go through.
That's actually very impressive.
It's very impressive, isn't it?
Very impressive.
I can and I don't feel sick. And at that time, I mean, if you invited me on this program to be a good influence,
I've already given up on that.
I'm going to let you down because a good 2-litre bottle of Coke next to me to wash it all down. I'm sorry.
I mean.
Not water. Coca-Cola. Full fat. None of this diet stuff. And there was no zero back then.
It's the noughties. You're in West London.
Yeah.
You could be in some of the greatest nightclubs ever.
Could be.
But where you are actually is you're on the sofa and you've got two packets of Jaffa cakes and a litre of what we call full fat Coke.
Yeah, full fat. I love it.
What a queen.
Yeah.
Your writing is going well, but then you add another string to your bow. You start directing.
Yes.
Your first feature film called A Way of Life.
Yeah.
About a teenage mother in a dilapidated Cardiff council flat. You write and direct it.
Mm.
It's like you weren't going to let anyone misinterpret your words. Now you have full control. Whatever you did, it absolutely works because this film wins a BAFTA for outstanding debut. Are you someone who celebrates with food?
I do, but I don't know if you'd call it celebration food. I do remember that night I got home because I went to parties, many parties afterwards. I got home quite late, 5 in the morning, maybe 4. And I had a chip butty and I'm still drinking my tea, and a good cup of tea is it's comfort food. I say I have comfort food much more than celebration food, if that makes sense.
It's the same thing though. You don't have to have oysters and caviar to celebrate.
Exactly. And I think because I have always been that recluse, it was a lot. It's a lot. And I kind of want to get home and I want to get my clothes off and I want to wrap the duvet around me. And I kind of want to feel okay and safe again, to be honest with you, because it's a bit of an out-of-body experience, to be honest with you.
Your films have been set in 18th century England,
mm-hmm.
pre-independence Botswana, mm-hmm. and Nazi Germany.
Yes.
They are often tales of love and the difficulties that come with it.
Yeah.
What makes you choose the stories that you do?
I go back to Grange Hill. And I think that the impact of story and culture, I was never going to be a politician. I didn't think I could be a doctor, but I understood that I could tell stories and impact people's lives. And so I always want to use story to suggest a bitter pill or offer a bitter pill. But part of that is to sugar the pill as well. And I think love is universal. Hopefully we've been loved by someone in our lives. And if we haven't, then we've usually loved someone. So we all know something of what that is.
You're in your 30s. You're researching a movie. And you meet the man who becomes your husband. Soren.
I do. Yeah.
So how does this innocent research trip turn into a whirlwind romance.
Probably because I wasn't being very innocent. It's the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me. You know, I go over and I need information from this man, and this man is not being forthcoming.
Where are you?
I'm in England, and he's in the Netherlands. He's in The Hague, working at Europol, which is the European police. And my assistant has found that this is the person that can give Amma the information she needs. And she's tried many times to get him to have a meeting with me. And eventually he agrees. And of course I get there and I travel all the way from England, and he's got the cheek to not even be there when I get to the country to see him. So I have to wait in the canteen of Europol, and I'm waiting there, and lunch is just finishing up there. Reminded me of Elstree, by the way, the canteen. And then everybody's sort of disappearing. And as everybody disappears, I just see this man coming towards me, weaving his way towards me and my assistant. And I can't explain it. I just knew that was going to be my husband. And I can't tell you why. There was nothing about him that was special in any way. And he's heard me tell this story many times, so he accepts it. But he was very ordinary, very ordinary. But I just knew he was going to be my husband.
You met in a canteen.
We met in a canteen because I'm classy like that.
Is food important to your relationship?
He loves through cooking. He says he hates it, but he loves. We had an argument on Saturday, and then I went to make my own dinner after I got off a couple of Zoom calls, and then he rushed to the kitchen and was like, are you doing that by yourself? And I was like, yes, I'm just going to chop up some onion and put it into my fish paste and put it on my bread and just have a very sad, you know, Saturday night meal. And he was determined to cook, and I actually gave him a night off. But he cooks well, and I love his cooking.
You moved to Copenhagen.
Yeah.
And you're still there now.
Yeah.
How tough a transition is it moving away from the UK?
It's a big transition. For me, it's a very, very big transition. I think if you look like a Dane, it's fine.
So is your diet at home very Danish?
My diet at home is very Søren, which is my husband. I don't know if it's very Danish, but it's very Søren, which is usually, you know, some good meat. He likes to experiment every now and then. We had ravioli, was one of the dishes at our wedding, and I never knew ravioli could be so good. And so,
not like the stuff out of a tin.
No, it was so good. It was so good. We got married in Paris, so it was, you know, whatever the French do with ravioli.
Yes.
He's a little bit experimental for somebody who makes ordinary meals. It's not very Danish, because, you know, very Danish to me is herring, and I can't do herring.
What is it about herring? What did herring do to you?
It's the smell. It's really the smell. And I had pneumonia not very long after arriving in Denmark. And I remember sitting at a big family dinner and a herring being passed around the table and not knowing that I had pneumonia. And I was feeling so sick, and I could smell the herring as it came round, and then it got under my nose. And I just remember my whole body kind of going into waves and thinking, my stepmother-in-law will never forgive me if I throw up at her beautiful table. And so now I have that fear as well attached to it. You know, I've got
herring and sultanas.
Oh,
that's two things that you don't like.
That just should not be said in the same sentence.
What do you really miss from South London when you're in fancy Copenhagen?
Really basic things. Cream crackers.
Jacob's cream crackers.
Jacob's cream crackers, I really, really miss.
Like buttered cream crackers.
Buttered cream crackers. Oh. Yeah. Oh. Kipling cakes, all kinds of Kipling cakes.
The little individual apple pies?
The little apple pies and the Thingiewell tarts. What are they called?
The Bakewell tarts.
The Bakewell tarts.
And Mr. Kipling Bakewell tart. Don't have them in Copenhagen.
No, the lemon slices they don't have. So I miss all of that. I miss really even just a straightforward PG tips. You know, builder's tea.
Yeah, that's what you asked for when you came in. I loved that I offered you a cup of tea. And you said, is it builders? I don't want any of those fancy.
Exactly.
Don't want anything. You were living in fear that I was going to bring you like a fennel and rose hip.
Oh, God. Exactly. When I was a baby, I remember I'd be tied on my mum's back, like you see African women carrying their babies. So I had this little red plastic cup with a lid on the top with a teat. And she'd put my tea in it. And I'd drink tea as a little lad as soon as I could drink by myself. I'd be on her back and I'd be drinking my tea. So tea, again, that's why I said tea's like a cuddle from my mum to me. So, and it has to be normal tea, you know?
Ama Asante, you've been an absolute joy. Thank you for eating with me.
Thank you so, so much. So, so much. I hope this will now be one of your new comfort foods.
All I want to do is put a tracksuit on and drink the custard from the jug.
There you go.
Is that so wrong? Is it wrong?
It's not so wrong. Thank There's no such thing as wrong when it comes to food, honestly.
You've got a BAFTA. I'm going to use that as an excuse.
This episode of Comfort Eating was produced by Jack Claremont. The executive producer is Lucy Greenwell. The music was written by Axel Kakutier. Mixing and sound design was by Solomon King. If you like Comfort Eating, then please go and leave us a review, and you can follow or subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And use the hashtag Comfort Eating Pod to get in touch about the podcast or share your own comfort eating delights.
This is The Guardian.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.